You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome back to part two of You Can't Say That. I'm your host, Tanya Pinkins, and you're listening to my conversation with Alice Spivak. Alice, I heard a rumor that you dated a big rapper.
A big rapper?
I think so. A big hip-hop artist. Did you ever?
No.
None?
No, I can't think of one. I mean, there were a number of them in my home, but...
No? You didn't have a hot love affair with a... With Which an African American.
Well, I've had love affairs with African Americans, but I don't remember.
But an actor, singer, rapper, artist, music recording artist. You mean this was a rumor that was just a rumor?
Oh, I love it. I didn't know there was a rumor about
it. Yes,
me.
There was.
There's usually rumors about
Harry.
That
was someone you were coaching. Was it Harry?
Well, Harry, there was always rumors about Harry because we were very close.
But were they true?
Well, I would say technically. It's hard to be around Harry. I mean, if
he's
you're
so handsome. At 98, then, he's still handsome.
Well, he's 90. What is he?
I thought it was like 98.
No, not yet. He and Sydney are both 90. They're going to be 94.
94.
In February, March. They're going to be in the next few weeks, they're going to be 94. They're 6 days apart.
Wow.
Sydney Poitier and Harry. No, I was with Harry. I would say that we were, you know, working again, similar to with Diane. I had a very strong, maybe it's the type of coach I am, I don't know, but I mean, he was my student. We were colleagues, we were writing things together, and we were close friends.
Okay.
And I was definitely in love with Harry. Oh. I will say that. And he appeared to be in love with me a few times. But that's that we can't understand. Oh. But he's not a rapper.
Okay.
A rapper, he's not. But he's a wonderful...
I guess I could say the name of who it was.
Oh.
But you're
afraid to? Because I know a lot of...
I can write it down. I could say it.
Okay. And then you can
It wasn't
edit.
You and LL Cool J?
Oh, no. I had never even met LL Cool J.
Okay, so I think that was just a rumor that wasn't true.
I am so thrilled.
I heard you and LL Cool J had a thing.
I love it. I've never met the man.
Okay.
He's fantastic. Okay. I've never met him. I still can meet him. No, I don't think so. But I have had lots of, from that... what is that group? Dirty Rotten Bastard. What was his name? He was in my
club. Oh, is that the Wu-Tang?
Yeah, the Wu-Tang Clan.
Did you date one of the Wu-Tang?
I had two of the Wu-Tang Clans as students.
Okay.
I had
Dirty Rotten, Old Dirty Bastard.
Old Dirty Bastard.
Old Dirty Bastard.
I was thinking of Frank's movie, Dirty Rotten Bastard.
Old Dirty Bastard. Who was the other one?
The very smart one, Q something. I have a terrible time with names.
Yeah, the other one. I know.
You're tall
he's got a TV series on Netflix where he does science stuff.
Well, he's so smart. And he was a fly. You know, he was somebody. The other guy who died, by the way, sadly, I think, this Old Dirty Bastard, what his name was. And I had... what's his name? Combs. When he was Sean Combs.
Sean
Combs.
How do you get all the black people?
I don't know. This is what something happened to me. I do teach at the New Federal Theater, which is Woody King.
Okay,
Jr.
okay.
So I've been teaching there since like the year 2000. And I used to get, and I don't anymore, which I think is a good sign, from Tanya, from other beautiful black women. So how come you were all with all these black people? And I went, do you have that black thing? And I'd say, so I didn't know how to respond, but I will respond. And I would say, I'm lucky. I'm just lucky that I have been in that community since early on, since the late 60s, to be sure. But earlier than that, I had students that I was also involved, like Arthur Mitchell, who started Harlem School of the Dance. And I helped Arthur really a little bit during that time to get out of the international world of ballet because he was the only black dancer internationally famous, and he felt very odd in Balanchine's company. And he eventually wanted to leave, and he wanted to start this magnificent, incredible thing, Dance Theater of Harlem. And I happened to, at the time, also been working with Leon Bibb, who was doing kind of a revival of Carnival that I was called to coach him, Leon, who I really admired tremendously. And Leon was one of the very first as a black person, to have a talk show on one of the networks. I can't remember which network. It was a Sunday. And I called Leon and I said, you know, Arthur Mitchell is in my class and he's talking about wanting to start a dance theater and everything. I think you should interview him. And that was the beginning of his publicizing it. Wow. So I was very excited about that. And I was a young teacher. I mean, I just had this wonderful guy in my class, and then I knew he was a dancer. I didn't know. I hadn't really been an aficionado of ballet, so I didn't know he invited me to the ballet when he did his last performance. Me and Georges Balanchine. I was very excited. But anyway, so I've been lucky in that sense. And I think it does come from my background, too, because...
What part of your background?
Well, where I was born. I was born in a part of Williamsburg, Brooklyn, which was an all-black neighborhood. Hmm. My parents were the janitors in a building, which was all-black, and they were immigrants from Eastern Europe. And to me... To be very honest, I moved to another neighborhood, which was more of a Italian Catholic neighborhood, and then eventually went to a high school and moved back into a black neighborhood, which was Bedford-Stuyvesant. So my whole young background was that I believed that everybody's parents came from somewhere else who were white. Everybody had accents. They all came from either Italy or Russia, Poland, or Lithuania. Like my father, my mother was from Russia and he was from Lithuania. And they never had schooling or anything like that. And to me, the black kids I knew had parents who were born here. So I said, oh, they're the Americans, because we never felt like we were American. I really never felt like an American until the 70s, to be honest with you.
Wow.
When people would ask me when I was in Europe, you know, are you an American? I'd say, no, I'm from New York. I just never felt any connection to it because of my whole background and what loomed over it, the Holocaust. And prior to the Holocaust was my mother's and father's Holocaust in Russia. So it was the world I lived in. And to me, my first boyfriend, I think, was the janitor. In another building we moved into, the janitor was next door to us. And Junior had a
bike.
And he would be, I'd be on his bike. So my point is, I simply was, until I came out of that very unschooled, uneducated background, immigrant neighborhoods, I didn't know anybody white whose parents were born here, really. And I was surprised. So I had to be around 16 or 17. And then I discovered also when I came into Manhattan, which we used to call New York. We lived in Brooklyn. That was New York. So I'm talking about way back. And so when I moved into New York, because I got engaged, got married, I was discovering that black people were considered second-class citizens. You know, that they were. I said, are you kidding? I didn't know about
racism.
This classic racism growing up. So maybe that's a lot to do with it. Aside from my total love of everything in art that connects to the black community. To me, the only truly American art form comes from the freed slaves, which is the gospel and the jazz and rock and roll
and the blues.
And the blues. That's truly American art form. Everything else was kind of brought from Europe. The only other true American art form were done by Jewish immigrants, which was called Hollywood. And that was developed the star system and created movies because they're the ones, the Mayors, the Warners, Ziegfeld, well, not necessarily Ziegfeld, the truly American, but Ziegfeld, you see, and all the people doing theater were borrowing it also mm-hmm. from Europe. So the only thing that really developed on this soil, I think, is the is music, black music, that came from the freed slaves, and that was, and the rhetoric. So, and of course, the poetry. I mean, there's really, there's no comparison. There's no comparison. So I was always enjoying very much when I got to be lucky enough to be involved with a black show or a black movie, because there was always much more you can dig into, much more in that pie that you could relish and see, and all the sad things and all the joyous things and everything. So all the movies that I was involved with because of Harry primarily, but because of Diane as well. And I also worked with Diana, who's going to be on Broadway now. Diana Ross. Yes.
What did you work with Diana Ross on?
Diana. Well, I met her earlier, and then I didn't. And then I was working with KISS, Gene Simmons. And she was with Gene at the time, and we met again, but I didn't work with her. And then after that, she became producer with ABC of three movies. It ended up she only really did one of them. And it was an excellent movie that she called me, and we worked very hard on it. It was about schizophrenia, and she was playing the mother of a young girl who was having schizophrenia, and her mother, the grandma, was also schizophrenic. And that's what happens. Schizophrenia runs through. It doesn't even skip it when she was also. Mm. It goes through the women. It's true of Marilyn Monroe and her mother and herself and her sister.
Mm. Well, journalists have degrees then, because my mother was schizophrenic.
She was schizophrenic, mm-hmm. yeah. Yeah, the degrees. And so we were working on that together for quite a while up in her place. It was fun. And that was fascinating. So when material comes to me from my white clients, it's hard put to find something really interesting other than some sort of, even it's television, of course, it's really very, very, unless it's Sopranos. I loved working, coaching on the Sopranos, because that was like coaching on plays, because you could take any Sopranos episode and put it right on the stage. Mm-hmm. It was so funny, mm-hmm. so well conceived and written. The characters were so terrific. So that I like doing, but if it's some kind of movie, it's usually, not very good. or God help us,
White ennui.
What do they call Hallmark or Lifetime or something. And nothing terribly interesting in it. I mean, I'm happy that as an acting teacher, I'm always involved with plays, because plays are something that keep giving. You don't ever get enough out of plays. Particularly, of course, you're going to do Chekhov and Shakespeare. You can be that forever. You could just stay in a room and forever read them, and you never get enough. It always, more is coming. Mm-hmm. In black film and black theater, there was always something to dig into, and you found it, and it was always very funny and very sad and very everything. So I just loved it so much more. I could just, you were swimming in it. Mm. So even ones that didn't quite do well was interesting working on, like Buck and the Preacher, for instance, which
you got to give us some of your resume, because it's not online. Nobody could go online and find it. So you got to give us some. I went online. I tried to find, you have this very, just not much of a digital footprint, and coaching, that wouldn't be a lot on IMDb. That's not a lot on IMDb. So tell us some of
the coaching. I see. But I thought, yeah, IMDb. I am listed with credits. So occasional coaching, I did get a credit.
So tell us some credits. You got to tell us some.
how can I?
Because I couldn't find it online. Buck and the Preacher.
Buck and the Preacher. Before that, I did, it was called The Angel Levine, which was also with Belafonte. But I had worked on a couple of films before that. There was, that I would work with the, quote, star of the film. Occasionally I was hired by the director, There was a couple of mini series. One was called, and these were awful, Lace 2. And it was Harem, which happened to have been Ava Gardner's last work. And Omar Sharif, it may have been his last too, because I don't know where.
And you got to work with Ava and Omar?
Ava and Omar and what's her name? Julia, who I really love, Julia Miles. Mm. And, and of course, Yaphet Kotto was in that. So I did get to work with Yaphet earlier when he was doing Great White Hope, when he replaced James Earl Jones.
Have you worked with James before?
With James? I never actually worked with James. I just adored him so much.
What about Cecily? I'm going to name names.
Cecily, I did once. I was called upon. She had a different coach who happened to be away. And so I was called. And I must say that wasn't a really very nice time, because Cecily had a couple of problems as a younger person. She used to get some kind of situation where she would stiffen up and couldn't move.
Oh.
So I thought she was so brilliant. As a young person, when she was doing those days of live television, even in the early days of TV, this was on stage. This was when she was doing To Be Young, Gifted, and Black in The Village. And so she was not happy because her own coach was away, Paul Mann. I've worked with Ruby and Ossie mm-hmm. Davis a lot. I really, really miss them too. They were like, you know, they were like this. To me, they were the pair.
Mm.
They were the first man and first lady
of the theater.
And because they were real and they were honest and they were fabulous and they were so talented. And I loved them too. And I worked a lot with them, not necessarily film, although Ruby was in Buck and the Preacher, but theater. And they had a television. They also had a little television show that they were given in the afternoons, I think on Sunday.
Mm.
So I worked with them, but there it's, I don't know where it would be listed. And, you know, and as an actor, I was planning like the early 80s to maybe move to LA and didn't want to. And then I didn't have to because I got very lucky and I got to work with Robert Stigwood, three films all overlapping. So I said, oh, I don't have to go to LA to make money. I can make money in New York. And so that was three things I was involved with. One was called Times Square. And the one never got on, which was the sequel to Saturday Night Fever. It got on much later. And one was Garbo Talks. That was with Sidney Lumet. What was the third one? Times Square. It's the big one. Oh, The Fan.
Okay.
Which is a kind of a cult film with Lauren Bacall. And that I worked on from beginning to end.
So you worked with Lauren Bacall?
Oh, yes. That was another big chapter. Talk about a diva. But here was a diva that wasn't, she was a child too. But it was really hard to get past her being mean to get to, so I just stayed clear and I better stay clear because she looked like she was going to kill me if I got anywhere near her. But then strangely enough, at the very end of the shoot, we all had to be together because I was working with a young man and the director of that movie. And we all had to be together in this one scene. And in the one scene, I went near her and became a little bit of her entourage because I wanted to hear about her stories, you know, although they were.
She's got to have great stories.
She had, and she loved telling them. And I said, well, let me get nearby so I can hear it. And James Garner was on it. He was very nice, and I'd known him before. So I'd sit with him, but she had her eye on Garner. So he said, you better not sit too close. You better sit close. Not that we were doing anything, but she was after him. And she was a bit of a vulture, to tell you the truth. So she... Miss Bacall, I still felt real sorry for her because anybody who'd been through the system, and she was very young when she went to Hollywood, and anybody who's been through all that, I want to heal them. I want to admire them. I mean, Judy Garland, it makes me cry what happened to them. Mm. I'm currently in a lot in this book about Carrie Fisher because I love Carrie. And to me, that was tragic. Mm. So all the people that, particularly females that suffered from that system.
So let's go with Carrie. What was the suffering? I mean, early days, they owned you. You couldn't, you know, do other movies. But Carrie's, I think of her as a contemporary. What would she suffer going through the studio system?
Because L.A. doesn't change. She suffered being a child of people who went through the system.
Got it.
Debbie Reynolds and Eddie Fisher. Mm-hmm. The children of those stars, too. I wanted to once write a book about how many committed suicide, which even includes Paul Newman, Edward G. Robinson, James Arness. How many became drug addicts? How many committed or attempted suicide? The Fonda children. So Bing Crosby had two sons, both committed suicide. So I wanted to write a book because it would be a study of American greed, really, and American royalty, which is movie stars. And so to me, Carrie was a terrible victim of all of that. But she herself was, as in the book continually says over and over, bipolar. So she had a lot of problems and she was a drug addict. Sad about Carrie. I knew that she wasn't going to make it. And then I knew her mother was going to die 24 hours later because I knew Debbie could never live without her. Mm.
It's interesting that you say this because I sometimes look at myself when I look at, you know, what I see, feel like I observe, and I'm like, oh, are you just being bitter? Are you just being jealous? But it often seems to me like the star system feels like there's some pimps at the top. We don't even really know who they are or their names, but you don't get to be a certain level of star unless you're in their stable.
They could prevent it.
They can prevent you, but if you're not in their stable, it ain't going to happen. And that there's just these prices that people pay, and we don't even know what they are, you know, but that when you get to a certain level, it's because somebody owns you and they're making a lot more money off of you
Absolutely.
Than you are ever making. And there are certain things you can't say and certain things you can't do. And that's the compromise you have to make in order. And I don't have that. So, but it's kind true. Of my observation is that.
It's true. And it will be ever more in the news now that Harvey Weinstein trial is starting. Because even people who had big careers like Ashley Judd are going to be speaking up. But they certainly can prevent it from happening. They certainly can, quote, blacklist you. Mm-hmm. That even happened again with a movie I was talking about, The Fan. The young fellow in it, who is no longer a young fellow, Michael Biehn, that was going to put him over the top. He was selected by Robert Stigwood because he saw him in some magazine. I don't know why. But anyway, Stigwood then kind of blacklisted him because he gave away the ending in some interview with some reporter on the West Coast, and he didn't mean to. and he said to the reporter, "You're not going to print this." And the reporter said, "No, I'm not going to print this." And so he didn't work for like 6 years. So they can do a lot. There's a lot of power up there. These people who get into power, I, of course, despise them because anybody who wants power is somebody I immediately despise. I don't know why. I despise, well, this is not going to help me, but so I better not say, you know, people who want to have power over other people. I don't understand what that is, but obviously it exists in certain human beings.
Yeah.
And there's definitely that in the entertainment industry. The entertainment industry was also very infiltrated by the mafia, the mob in the early days, because it was another place that they could make a profit. That meant you had to.
And you could launder a lot of money.
Yeah, and you launder a lot of money, and this, you had to be part of the firm, as now they're talking about the royalty in England that way. But I guess in a lot of industries, you have that. in somehow in the arts industry, it's really the saddest because the people that are being, exploited and used and told what to do and stopped from working and all of that are very vulnerable people. These are artists, actors, musicians, composers, writers, people who don't want to have power over other people but need to express themselves. And that need to express themselves makes them easily
exploitable
and victimized by these other people. So it is sad. And I have always seen that, even from very young. When I first went out there to Hollywood, I smelled it. And I said, oh, my goodness, this is a really bad place. Mm. It's a bad thing. And I couldn't understand why a Black performer, I remember saying to Roz Cash, how could you move out here? Mm. It to me, out there, there was even you could almost see the barbed wire. It was like in the South, you know, you could say, well, this is the railroad tracks. This is where you live. Mm-hmm. I mean, why would you want to be there? And then the few that would pop out and be in Bel Air or something like right. Sydney. But Harry never wanted to go out there, and rightfully so. He and I had both strong feelings against that atmosphere. Mm-hmm. But yeah. So in terms of the business, yeah, I am very outspoken about it. It hasn't helped me maybe in my own little job hunts, but
You're doing okay, aren't you?
Yeah. Okay, meaning, you know, as long as I'm in control of it, I can say, starting
yes.
a class. Anybody
Woman
want to come into the class?
What
come
class? On. Tell us about the class.
Well, the classes, I just started one again. I've never stopped teaching.
Absolutely.
So if a big coaching job comes up or an acting job, which occasionally comes up, or a tour, then I will hold off the classes. But and then it will have to take second place for that period of time. But I'll never stop teaching. I'll never stop teaching. People, Uta Hagen, who was my mentor, who made me a teacher, she said, the day I don't want to go into classes, the day I will stop teaching. I don't know if she followed that through, but I understand it. I mean, I could be tired sometimes and think, oh, no, I have to go over to the class. But I'll never stop teaching.
Because what does it give you?
I think it's just something that's in you, teaching. I don't know. I know that when I was 8 years old, I would babysit and be the monitor of younger kids. That I just always felt I had to take care of people. And I love teaching. Yeah, I love it.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
And you teach at On the Road Repertory Company?
No, well, that's something separate.
Oh.
On the Road Repertory Company started in 2012.
Okay.
And I started teaching in 1962. So there was a little bit of a
Okay, so what is the name of the school you have?
The school I don't have. I'm just independent. For 15 years, I taught it at HB Studio, which was called Herbert Berghoff Studio at that time. And then after that, I went on my own. And so that was in the late 70s. I've been on my own ever since.
So how do people find you?
Well, it's always been word of mouth, but maybe now.
Well, here's some word of mouth. This is word of mouth. How do we find Alice Spivak? We want to coach with her.
If you want to, you can go to alicebivakclasses@gmail.com.
Okay.
All right. alicebivakclasses@gmail.com. I've never advertised, Tanya. This is kind of weird. One, of course, I started out at HB Studio, so they did all the, I was just in the faculty, and I developed my own group of people, and I became popular within the school. But when I went out on my own, then, of course, if you wanted to make some dough, you had to, like, advertise. I never did. It was all based on people who remembered me, who told somebody else, or casting people or producers and directors who knew me and would send people to me. And that would be for either coaching or the classes. So both of those things, I've never really had an ad. It's always been someone told someone who told someone. So it means that I can have very low times, and that's all right too. But I'm always enough to have a class. So I just started one. And my classes these days are only advanced scene study, because I would love to teach technique and beginners. I do that anyway. I would on one-on-one, I teach any level of actor. But for classes, they have to have had experience and or training. And then I can get into really good material. So I really love teaching about plays and theater. And I tell everybody, unless you know about plays and theater, you'll never get a television job. Mm. Because all the British actors who take all your roles, any color actor, how about this Miss Erivo now? She's doing Harriet Tubman, all the iconic American heroes and heroines are played by British people. Get that. And you will find out in the awards when they start speaking in their own dialect. However, I said that 25 years ago. I saw that happening. And beyond that, more than 25 years ago, in the 50s of the last century, the Brits started to take over New York theater. And Actors Equity, the union, stepped in and said, you cannot have an English actor playing in New York unless an American actor can play in the West End or off the West End. And so they had a deal. And that deal remains. But Screen Actors Guild, which is now SAG-AFTRA, never made any deal. So all the British actors come in. And
Australian.
Australian is part of the UK. So you have Australia, even. I used to put Canada in it, but I don't as so much anymore. But it was Canada. Ireland, Wales, England, Australia are all the actors.
And so as our wrap-up advice, how are we American actors going to compete with the Brits?
Which is why I still teach and probably will be teaching even after I die and I'll be in my grave. Because my story, what I tell everybody is, unless you know as much as they know, you're not going to be able to win the role. Mm. And it takes a lot of doing. They cut their teeth in the theater. They know the classics. So when they get something for a TV pilot, which is a doctor, a lawyer, or whatever, they know what else to do with it to make it something. Because anything written for TV, other than maybe some of the streaming shows these days, but anything written for TV has no subtext, has no originality, has nothing. It's just copycat formula writing. And it's very hard to add. You have to add some subtext to it. Whereas you look at a play and you have to dig to find the subtext, and it will be there if you know how to dig in. But with the television play and a lot of movie scripts, if you dig in, you'll just fall down on the floor. There's nothing there. It's only what it says on the surface. You know, Shakespeare also, there's no subtext, but look what it says on the surface. But in movies and TV, what it says on the surface is something you've heard before a million times, and it doesn't really matter, and actors will say it the way they want to say it anyway. But the British actor comes in and says, oh, dear, look at this. So he's a lawyer. It's in an office. Well, this reminds me of Richard II. When the... And they start to look into what else is going on that they can invent and put in. And then you get these incredibly interesting characters that were never written down because the people who are writing for TV haven't got a clue about character. They only know this is a prostitute, this is a shopkeeper, this is a housewife. They only have categories. They don't have character like plays do. So the Brit brings in the character and they get the role, whether it's Kate Winslet or Nicole Kidman or, Russell Crowe and Christian Bale and every single one of them. And now Cynthia Erivo and that wonderful gal, I always forget her name, who did
Lupita Nyong'o.
Yeah, she's marvelous. And also the gal who played Ruth in The Last Raisin in the Sun.
Nega? Ruth Nega?
Oh, no, she's wonderful too.
I know you're talking about Sophie.
Yes, Sophie. Yes. They're wonderful.
Yeah, they are.
Now, there are wonderful American actors, too, but they can't win that role if they can't bring it something in that wasn't there to begin with. Because it's not there in television and film scripts.
Oh.
It's just an outline. It's nothing there. You know, as a movie script is written three times. You have a movie script. Hopefully, it's perfect. You've got it all together. You've got all the scenes numbered. Then you shoot it. You rewrite it all. Based on the actor, based on the weather, based on time. Then you finish the shooting, you get rid of everybody, and you rewrite it all in the editing room. So yes. Now you're rewriting it all again. So there is nothing there. But so in that beginning, when an American actor comes in to see someone for a job, what are they going to bring with them into that? What background can they bring with them into that part, because it's highly competitive. And since nobody wants to pay anything anymore, everybody is working for less than they would normally work for if there weren't such a thing as salary suppression. They just, the casting or the producer or whatever just says next. If that person puts up a fight at all, no, the next. We have somebody else who can come in and who can read for it. So auditioning is very, very difficult here. I had a British actor who was in my class who said, it's so strange. He said, when I go to audition in England and they call me for a part, it can be 12 other men that they call. And here when I'm called, they cast this wide net. They may be seeing hundreds of people.
And if it's black, they could be 16 to 80. It's just somebody black in the 16 to 80 range. just a black person.
Doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And then what's really sad these days, and it's I'm fighting it, because we see so many more, thank God, so many more black faces, a lot of them British, in film and on television, that the young white actor coming up is this sort of reverse kind of racism, saying, well, if you're not black, you can't get anything. And when they write all ethnicities, it means I can't get a job. And I said, shut up. How dare you? How dare you say that the blacks are keeping you from working? Let's look at history here. Don't worry about it. You'll get your job. Just get better. Get better. How are you going to compete? You didn't compete with that person. And so it's an interesting, a lot of stuff going on. You were saying one of the differences between then and now. Now there seems to be a great many more opportunities. We have, I don't know how many channels and 5 million streaming things and Hulu and Disney and Netflix and all of this stuff and no work for people. So how does that make sense? So there are so many opportunities and for some reason, harder to get a job.
That people, is true, my experience as well.
Exactly. And anybody who's had backgrounds such as you are finding it harder to get a job in a time when all this opportunity supposedly is there.
Well, I think it's because the net has been cast wider, and because of self-tapes, and the dearth of material, there are more casting directors. So they're casting directors who have maybe just cast for the first time. They don't know the actors who work all the time, but then that's opening it up for a whole bunch of actors who haven't worked all the time. And so now you're competing with 1,000 people mm-hmm. rather than the 10 because they're getting tapes from all over the world. And maybe they get bored after the first 20 tapes and you weren't in the first 20 tapes, so you didn't get the job. Or I've even had things where I've gone in for something, you know, episodic, not too deep, and they've been like, we wanted to come back to make an adjustment. Uh-huh. And I'm like, did they look at my resume? Like, can I look at my reel to know that I can make an adjustment? Then I'll come back in and do the adjustment, and I still won't get the job. So I'm like, you know what? Y'all not looking for me.
That's it. You would just...
Y'all don't need me to come work for you.
It used to mean something. We used to have, at least, even in terms of money, TVQ. You know, where you'd, if you made did a certain number of jobs at scale, you were certainly going up from scale. Now, no, I still go in there for scale.
You know, everybody's because, scale, that's it.
So this that's called salaries.
Unless question. You're in the right harem.
Yes.
If well, you're
then,
in the right
then
harem.
You jump up, and then there's such a, again, disparity, just like there is in this country,
right.
between what one person makes and what the generally public makes. So this salary suppression actually started in the 90s, I think, really seriously, of the last century, where it really clamped down on no more TVQ. You know, you don't
and no more even getting paid what your rate was.
You have no work. Rate. That's, right. That's what the TVQ
Yeah, it's happening
was.
For directors
no
and everything.
No more rate. Yeah. So they've done that. And then, as you say, they cast the wider net around the globe because of self-taping. And nobody knows anything. But there's a little bit of that was true way back when. In the early days of Hollywood, I remember hearing the story. You know, anybody could become a casting director in Hollywood. I remember one who became the casting director for all of NBC. And I think that her credentials were that she babysat some actress who was in some nighttime soap. I forgot her name. Her child. So she became the casting director. So the casting directors were just, and they would be new ones. And the story goes that it was Shelley Winters, I think, who came up. Yeah, probably Shelley came to a casting director's office in LA, and the young woman behind the desk says, "So tell me what you've done." And Shelley reached into her bag and she took out two Oscars and she put it on the desk. And she says, "Now tell me what you've done."
And that's a great note to end for my talk with Alice Feedback. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Always a pleasure talking to you.
I know. And I you are one of my favorites. So
oh,
there you
thank
are.
You.
This is a brilliant challenge.
Thank you. Well, you are listening to You Can't Say That, the show where you can on the Broadway Podcast Network. And I am Tanya Pinkins. And thank you to my guest, Alice Feedback. How come you don't say no
when you mean no? Thanks for listening to You Can't Say That, the show where you can. I'm Tanya Pinkins, and You Can't Say That is part of the Broadway Podcast Network, produced by Dori Berenstein and Alan Seals. Edited by Derek Gunther, with music by Kat Dale. If you like what you hear, don't forget to subscribe and rate this podcast highly wherever you stream. Follow me on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Tanya Pinkins. And to learn more, visit bpn.fm/YCST. Stay safe.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical, Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Suffs has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.